Hey, this is Miss Melissa, the Bathtub Mermaid, and you are listening to Tales from the Tub. This is Melissa, the Bathtub Mermaid, and I am here with my good friend, Becca, who I've never met in person, even though we've known each other online for the better part of a decade at this point.
I think so.
So, Becca, what I'd like to... Did you prefer Becca or Rebecca, first of all? Because I know you as both.
Becca, most people call me.
Okay. So what I'd like you to do is tell me a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay, I do a multitude of different things, none of which are hugely important, but they are to me. I write a blog, and I've written one book. I'm working on another book. I play music. I play piano for myself mostly, and I play handbells in an ensemble with 15 other women and one man. And so we travel around and play music all over the place with our handbells and our truck full of stuff. And I'm a wife and a mom and a grandmother and a dog mother and a daughter who takes care of an elderly mom who needs some extra help. I love to read. I love to take long walks with my dogs. I love to just be quiet and do my thing.
I want to talk a minute about your first book because, as you know, I read it and I loved it and I reviewed it for my blog, but I'd like you to tell us a little bit about it.
Well, my first book was actually a compilation of blog posts that I'd written over a period of about almost 10 years. I started writing a blog when I turned 50. It was kind of my gift to myself to get back into writing after years of not writing a word. And my son, who's always been a techie, had been writing a blog since 1994. And I thought, well, this is pretty cool. I could do that too. So I started writing my blog pretty soon after I started my blog, which was called Life in General, and which was just really about my life at that point in it, being a middle-aged woman, kind of coming to terms with the fact that I was, as I put it, halfway through my century on Earth, and trying to make sense with words of all the experiences that were happening to me in those years, of parents getting sick and dying, of children moving away, of having an empty nest, changing jobs, all those kinds of things that are so common when we get to that point in our lives. And I used writing my blog to help me understand those things and deal with them. And then in the process of that, I started connecting with so many other women at various stages of life, and we would share our experiences through our blog posts. And I met just tons of really great people, you among them, and learned so much and got so inspired by everything that was going on out there, creatively speaking. So a few years ago, I decided to put together kind of the best of the best of those blog posts. By the time I started thinking about this, I think I had about 4,000 blog posts. And I wanted to just put together a collection in a printed book so I had them all in one place. I just didn't want them out in the ether. And I wanted to give it to my friends and my family as a gift, you know, a small, like a keepsake. So that was my idea with Life in General, and I curated a bunch of blog posts, put them all together in a book, had it self-published, and I had 50 copies published, and I was going to give them as Christmas gifts. Well, things started snowballing, and people started giving my book to their friends who would call me and say, I want to buy 10 copies, I want to buy 20 copies, and so I started having to have more copies printed, and it just became such a great experience for me to see how my book was connecting with all kinds of other women who would contact me and say, I thought I was the only one who'd felt that way when their kid left for college, or I thought I was the only one who had those same feelings about working at my age, or I thought I was the only one whose mom was sick and demanding and needed me all the time. So it was a really enlightening experience for me. It helped me feel better about the things I was going through to know that I had helped these women. So the book itself is a series of short, inspirational kind of essays, I guess is the best way to describe it. And it's about everything that goes on in our lives in general today as women. And
it's a really, really lovely book. I thought, even though you and I are not quite in the same generation, I thought a lot of it was really universal.
That's good. I'm glad to hear that. And we're not, and we don't have quite the same experiences. And I had one young woman who read the book, and she said something that I thought was really, was very gratifying to me. She said, I'm going to put this book away, and when I get to be older, I'm going to get it back out because I think it's going to really help me. So,
oh, that's really lovely.
I know. I felt like that was, well, if I can even, connect with somebody that far in the future, that's very cool.
I don't want to be presumptuous, but a lot of it really felt like I was getting advice from like an older sister or a favorite auntie.
I love that. That's great. I'm glad about that. And I think I felt that way with I connected with older women, and a lot of my best friends are 20 years older than I am. So I know that feeling, and it's a good feeling.
I think it's really important also that as women, we support other women rather than competing with them.
Oh, I agree. I totally agree. And I have felt so supported. I've really been lucky that way. Everyone I've worked with in my life in every capacity. And I think I've been really lucky because I've worked nearly all my life with women bosses, quote unquote, who are actually more like friends and mentors in every way. And it's been so good for me to have those kind of examples of people to work with and learn from and be inspired by. So.
Speaking of inspiration then, is there a specific piece of wisdom or advice that you've given or received that you think should be shared?
You know, I think the most important thing that we don't do, and we let ourselves get so busy with outside things that we don't appreciate the small things in life. I think that's the thing I've learned in my middle age years so much more, is to just take time and really enjoy the everyday moments of every small thing that happens during the day. You know, the moments that you have when your dog wakes you up and wants his belly rubbed. and when your grandson wants to play a board game for the umpteenth time, and you really think, well, I need to start dinner, and I got bills that need to be paid, and I should go sweep the floor, but no, you just sit there, because those are the kind of moments that only come every so often, and they're fleeting, they disappear, and I just want to store all those up in my memory and keep them. So I really think if we could all just slow down a little bit and just learn to appreciate everything we do each day, we'd all be a little bit happier and less prone to flying off the handle, and we'd just be calmer and nicer people all the way around.
Probably true. What's a typical day for you, other than, you mean, dog belly rubs are really important, but what else?
Dog belly rubs are the beginning of every day. The most important part of my day is morning. I think I'm an early riser, and it's just all downhill from there as far as I'm concerned. Sometimes by the time my husband gets up, I'm already done for the day. I'm like, okay, I've had it. This is as much as I can do today. But I do like to get up really early. I like to have my coffee. I like to read my books for a while and then do some writing for a while and just kind of be quiet, watch the sun come up if it's, you know, if it's late enough in the year that it's not up when I get up already, and just watch the world come alive. That's my best time of day. And then every day for me is a little bit different because I do so many different things. Some days I have music rehearsals, and some days I still do some part-time work at my office job and I go there. And some days I have things to do for my mom. So every day is just a little bit different during that 10 to 5 time period when most people go to their offices, I'm doing a bunch of different things. I try to get some writing in there, but usually I try to get all my writing done in the morning early, and then I can concentrate on the dog belly rubs and feeding and all that stuff. I have a finicky dog, as you know, and I have to set aside half an hour to feed him a meal.
I have a dog like that. He's an 80-pound wood.
Oh, crazy, isn't it?
There was a point where we were literally hand-feeding. I have the only dog in the world that does not want to eat.
Oh, no, I have that one, too. I have to hand-feed my dog. People think I'm crazy.
But it's either that or they don't eat until it's, like, an inopportune time, and then their schedule is completely off, and then your schedule is, you know.
I know. So next time you're hand-feeding him, just think about me hand-feeding mine. I'm doing the same.
All right. It's good to know there's company in this.
Yeah.
Other than finicky dogs, if you could solve one of the world's problems, big or small, what would it be?
Finicky dog problems are big problems to me. I've been really preoccupied lately with the idea of what's going to happen to all these people in my generation who are getting old and or maybe live to be 100, which I'm counting on. But I'm just wondering, I'm thinking that we don't deal particularly well with the elderly in this society, and we tend to shuffle them off into places that are not ideal and try to take over their lives as if they were children. And I think we need to figure out how to handle that better. I think that's a real problem. It's going to be a problem for my generation as we get older. That's been preoccupying my thoughts a lot. The other thing that really worries me now is, and I may make enemies by saying this, but the pervasive gun culture in our society is just really making me nervous.
I think that's very valid, especially, I mean, look at what happened yesterday.
Yeah.
That was horrible. It's horrifying. And we've gotten to the point where we just go, oh, well, it's just, you know, that's how we live here.
Yeah, and that's a very scary thought to me. I can't imagine how it's gotten to be this way in our country, but it's almost like we live in a terrorist nation where we're terrorizing ourselves.
You know, my parents live in Mexico, mm-hmm. and they constantly get people who are going, well, don't you feel unsafe? But the reality is that there are fewer murders in an entire year in Mexico than there are in, like, Texas in a month.
I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all.
And most of it is just druggies going after other druggies, so they're really doing the country a service.
In the long run, yes, they probably are. But it's a totally different problem here, and it just seems to be getting worse, as if there's just so much anger and rage out there.
I think a lot of it is that we have all this anger and rage and we don't have a healthy way of dealing with it.
I think so, yeah. I was reading something today, I think it was something by Brené Brown, and she was talking about how since 9/11, our culture has been almost like we're suffering from post-traumatic stress as a culture, as a nation. And we've just drawn inward and become very paranoid and wary and angry. Well, and it's coming out in all these things like these shootings and, you know, people having so many mental health problems. And I think there's a lot of truth in that.
It's really scary, and it really explains why the generations behind mine, like the millennials who are coming into their adulthood now, are so disenfranchised.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I can see that. And they seem hopeless. They feel like things are hopeless.
I don't think we've done them a very good service, any of us. But we're getting morbid. So when a mood strikes you, a bad mood or a really challenging mood, how do you shake yourself out of it?
I'm back.
You're back. I lost you. What happened?
I don't know. Just all of a sudden, I didn't move. I promise I didn't move.
That's okay.
It just said call ended. I don't know.
That was weird. It happens sometimes.
So anyway, we're talking about bad moods.
Right. Do you want me to repeat the question?
You asked me what I do to get out of a bad mood, and I said I start with a couple of glasses of wine, and if that doesn't work.
That's fantastic. Better white.
If that doesn't work, then I might seriously, if that doesn't work, I take a walk. Walks always help me get out of a bad mood. Reading a good book will help me get out of a bad mood. Pounding something on the piano, like Beethoven sonatas or something like that, really loud, big chords. That always helps me get out of a bad mood.
So. I love it. Guerrilla piano.
Yep. Therapy by piano. But those are some of my best ways. It's usually better for me to be by myself and not talk to anybody till I get over it. My husband would tell you the same thing.
I think that's probably wise. And it's good that you know that about yourself. So many people don't.
Yes. I've learned through experience.
You've mentioned reading several times, and I know that, like me, you are a voracious reader. So is there a book or movie or TV show or a song that's particularly meaningful to you right now?
Right now? There's nothing on television right now that's worth watching as far as I'm concerned. There is a book that I've been reading that I've actually read two times in a row in the last 2 months, and it's called The 10 Letters Project. It's a book by Jen Lee and Tim Manley. And in this book, these two people, they're both filmmakers, storytellers, improvisers, writers. They take on a project of writing each other 10 emails back and forth. And it's an artistic interchange about what's going on in their work, what they're scared of, how they cope with it, and how their life intersects with their work on a daily basis. And it's been really enlightening and inspiring to me to see this interchange between these two artists. And it's kind of given me some ideas about things I might want to do going forward in the same sort of a creative vein. So that's been an important book for my summer reading. My favorite television show, and this is a show that was really meaningful to me and I loved it in the past decade, was Parenthood. I just was so attached to that show and everybody in it. I felt like I was part of that big Braverman family. And I think some of that comes from the fact that I have such a tiny family. I love TV shows or movies or books about big families because I can kind of insert myself in there and live vicariously, have all those brothers and sisters in a sort of unrealistic way.
Without the actual fuss.
Yeah, without having to actually have them over for dinner or anything.
That's cool. What's something that sets your soul on fire?
Oh, wow. Besides music, I think music probably more than anything really excites me creatively. Playing music, especially with a group, like I do with my handbell group, is a real thrill for me. And performing, even though I consider myself very introverted in a lot of ways, I love to perform music, and I don't have much stage fright. I used to, but I've gotten over that, and it's so much fun to perform for a good audience of people. And it's very exciting and exhilarating, and it's a lot of fun for me to perform and play music. Right now, I'm kind of obsessed with this idea of creative connect. I love to be able to connect with people in a through a creative manner, either through writing, like we connect on blogs, and through my book with connecting with people who've read it, and then through music, it's the same kind of thing. You work together in that creative aspect and then you share it and you get the feedback. And I love that. I get really excited about doing that. So that's kind of what sets my soul on fire most of the time.
Do you have a favorite composer? Do you prefer classical or contemporary? Or do you play a little bit of everything?
You know, for piano music, Chopin has always been my favorite. I just love he's just so much emotion in the music. I don't know, there's something, and there's some darkness to almost everything he writes that appeals to the dark side of me. I'm always leaning a little bit toward the dark side of everything. You know, I like those sorts of sad movies that make you cry. And so I love Chopin music for piano.
I think it was someone who's in more of my generation, Joss Whedon, who said that you have to go to the dark places because that's where the fairy tales live.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really, really good insight.
Yeah. Because that's where the fairy tales live. I like that. Well, you have to come face to face with the big bad wolf once in a while, I guess. And
you do, because if you're not facing it and working through it, then you're empty.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about that.
I vaguely recall us having a conversation in email at one point about the fact that you were also an only child. Am I remembering that incorrectly?
Oh, no, I'm an only child. I come from this vast network of only children.
I bring this up because you were saying that you always thought that you were an introvert. And you're not going to believe this, but for much of my life, I always thought I was an introvert. And then I realized that there are crossovers between being an introvert and being an only child, and a lot of times because you're an only child,
mm-hmm.
you act like an introvert, but you're really not one, because only children tend to be used to being alone and very self-directed.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting viewpoint. I mean, I've always figured that my introversion was directly related to being an only child, and it never occurred to me that maybe I'm not quite as introverted as I think I am. but yeah, I mean, the whole only child thing, you know, my husband's an only child, my son is, my mother is, and now it looks like my grandson will be. So
wow.
We have this whole little network of only children, and I see so many of the same characteristics. But when my husband and I first got together, both of us being only children, you know, everybody was like, well, this is just a match made in hell, because look at these two spoiled only children, selfish, always had their way. They're never going to get along. But I think it's really been good because we really get one another. You know, we get the fact that we need a lot of space. We need quiet time. And we each understand that about each other. So we don't push each other's buttons in that direction. So
that's really important.
It is important. But I do think being an only child does tend to make you a little bit more introverted, because you're used to just your own quiet life, and you learn how to be your own best friend really early.
You have to.
Yeah.
Self-preservation.
Yeah. Yeah. You know that.
Do I ever.
Yeah.
I was always so used to being the only kid in any environment.
Yes, me too.
So it makes you much more verbal, I think, also, than kids who have siblings.
Oh, yeah. And you're,
or at least verbal in a different way.
You're much more comfortable with adults from an early age.
Yeah.
And I've always been more, and that maybe that's why all my friends are 20 years older than I am, because I've always been more comfortable with older people than people my own age.
That's really interesting. And that may be true.
And I'm very comfortable with younger people, like people my son's age, but people in my own age group, you know, 50-ish, 50 to 60, I'm always a little bit leery of, because we have too much in common, I guess. I don't know.
Is there any particular person in your life who's been a special influence on you?
Oh, yes. That's an easy question. I have a friend named Pat, and Pat's one of those women she's 15 years older than I am, and when I first went back to work after my son was, he was 10, and I had been home with him the whole time. And I went back to work as an accompanist, a piano accompanist for a high school program, our high school choral program. And Pat was the director. And so she became my boss, so to speak. But she also became my best friend and my mentor. And she taught me, oh my goodness, I can't even begin to tell you all the things she taught me. She taught me confidence. She taught me how to step outside my box. She taught me how to let my son grow. She has introduced me to practically every friend I have.
Wow.
It's even because of her, in a long roundabout way, that I have my dogs. So.
Wow. That's pretty influential.
She has, in the last 20 years, she has probably changed every aspect of my life in some way or another. She's a very influential woman. And you can imagine if she did that for me, I was almost 40 when I met her, all the good that she's done for high school students that she taught over a period of 25 years.
Oh, that's incredible.
I know. I wish I had had her as a teacher. My life would have been a lot different.
And she'd make a great interview.
She would make a great interview.
If you could have dinner with one historical figure, celebrity, or fictional character, who would you choose?
You know who I would love to sit down and spend an evening with is the author Anna Quindlen.
Oh, wow.
Because she has been my inspiration for writing since I was 25 or 6 years old. She and I are about the same age. Our kids are about the same age. And she started writing her column for the New York Times about, I think it was called Living Out Loud. And it was the kind of thing that I write for life in general. She was writing about her life as a mom and a wife and a mother and a writer. And she wrote a column for the New York Times about this. And in the 1980s, that was pretty cool that kind of topic got space in the New York Times. So I fell in love with her column. Then she started writing novels. Then she started writing political commentary for Newsweek. And I was so proud of her, as if we were sisters. But I've just followed her all through. I read everything she writes. I love her books. I love her essays, her novels, everything. And I would just love to sit down with her and just have some coffee or have lunch and move on to having wine and just talk about families and life and what the world is like now and how it's changed. And I just would adore doing that.
I bet she'd probably adore it as well. Is there a charity or cause you feel really strongly about?
Yeah, I mean, you will understand this because I think this is a cause you feel very strongly about. I feel so strongly about animal welfare causes, rescue dogs, all kinds of animal welfare. That's one of the things that's it's a real hot button for me. I just have no sympathy for people who abuse animals in any way or don't take care of their animals. It's a big thing for me. So that's one of my causes I always contribute to money-wise, time-wise, whatever I can do. So it's important.
That's really lovely. I know that you're also a big proponent of arts in the schools.
I am a big proponent.
So will you talk about that for a moment?
I think we're facing some really big dilemmas, cutting arts programs in schools. It's happening all over. It's happening here much more often than I'd like to see. And I think aside from the fact that music has been scientifically proven over and over again to be so beneficial in learning math and learning reading, in developing memory, in developing good attention skills. And these kind of scientific studies are showing that this is a lifelong benefit, not just the kind of thing that happens while you're doing music, but it's something that actually alters your brain chemistry. Music and art are wonderful therapeutic tools. Having worked in music in schools for the better part of my life, I have seen so many young people whose lives have been literally saved by the fact that they were in a music program, they felt it was a place they were safe, that they could express themselves artistically, that they had that outlet, that they had teachers who understood them and wanted to help them feel more confident and sure of themselves through their art. It's a priceless thing, and so many young people have no other exposure to it except in school, and it can change their lives. I've seen it happen dozens and dozens and dozens of times. So I just really feel like we need to keep music available to kids at all costs throughout their entire schooling. It's just one of the most important things we can do for them.
I know personally, I do not believe I would have survived elementary school or high school if it hadn't been for music.
I understand that completely. I feel the same way. And I know lots of other people do too. So I just think that's something that we really have to address in society. It's too important to let that disappear from our culture for kids and for their future.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I'm going to ask you now where you can be found in media, online, etc.
Where can I be found? I'm all over the place. I have a blog, a website at BeccaRowan.com. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and everything is Becca Rowan. So it's pretty easy to find that way. I do Goodreads, too, where I share book recommendations. So all those places.
And, of course, your book is on Amazon, right?
My book is on Amazon. It's called Life in General, and it can be purchased through Amazon. There's a Kindle edition, which is only 99 cents. and you can also purchase hardcover or softcover copies through my blog on my website.
The Bathtub Mermaid is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartell and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 4.0 International License. Music for this episode was provided by Mevio's Music Alley, a great resource for PodSafe music. Visit them at music.mevio.com. The opening song is Soap in a Bathtub by Stony. The closing song is You Can Use My Bathtub by Little Tom. The Bathtub Mermaid is produced and recorded using Boss Jock and Audacity. You can contact me by leaving a comment at the website, www.bathtubmermaid.com, by finding me on Twitter, at Melisse, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E, or by sending an email to Melisse, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E, at starfleet.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, never let your bathwater get too cold.
Still it shows, but you can use my bathtub. Understand, you can use my bathtub.